How do you set a love story in the wake of the Chernobyl nuclear plant disaster? Dara McKeown has done so and is here to talk about his first novel, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air.
I'm a guy sitting in a room writing a novel about Chernobyl who's from Ireland. So that just sounded like such an outlandish thing to do that I took a long time before I admitted that to myself and a very long time before I admitted that to other people.
What does our penchant for reality TV tell us about ourselves? Christopher Beha will join us to talk about his new novel, Arts and Entertainments.
I think that reality television is bad for our souls. And good novels ought to be trying to restore that sense of the importance of the inner life.
My colleagues Parle Segal and Greg Coles will join me to talk about this week's cover review, Patti Smith on Haruki Murakami. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Dara McKeown joins me now. He is the author of a new novel, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air. Hi, Dara.
Hi.
So this is a novel about Chernobyl. How did you come to write a book about the nuclear disaster?
Through a very long and circuitous route. So I'm from Ireland. And actually, the disaster is quite a present issue in Ireland, solely because there's an Irish charity called Chernobyl Children's International. They were set up in the late 80s, and they bring over children from Chernobyl to Ireland for recuperation. And so I think over the years, they've brought about 20,000 kids to Ireland. So Ireland is the kind of country that everybody knows everybody. So at some stage, you usually know someone who has taken in a Chernobyl child into their house. A lot of people around the country would know that. And so they, you know, they came to my very small hometown in the middle of Ireland when I was about 12 or 13. And they were actually some of the first foreigners I'd ever met. Looking back, and there was many reasons that I wrote the novel, but if I really look back to the root of it, I'm sure my fascination started there.
And now, were these children orphaned, or...?
They were from various circumstances. A lot of them, you know, weren't kind of disfigured in the way that we would associate with Chernobyl, but a lot of their issues were internal issues. But some of them were orphans, some of them were from families who were in the directly in the zone, some of them were from Kiev. So it was a kind of a broad range of kids that came over.
And did you know any personally? Were you
some of my friends would have had them in their houses. You know, none of them spoke English and nobody in my hometown spoke Russian. So, but that was quite interesting as well, that we would kind of glean little insights into their lives through secondhand information or, you know, through the kind of just human ability to communicate. So that was quite intriguing as well.
There are, of course, many contemporary Irish novelists and a recent, I think, surge in novelists coming out of Russia, some of them recent immigrants to the U.S. But you sort of decided to bridge those two things in your own way. Did you feel any trepidation setting your novel entirely in Russia?
Yes. I think I approached it from a couple of ways. First of all, it really came out of reading. I didn't sit down and decide I'm going to write a book. I started reading into the incident, and the more I read into it, the more that I found it was just so rich in terms of the tension. Actually, I think that was happening because it's a disaster that's a very quiet disaster, and so there is an inherent tension in the landscape, in the way that we talk about it. There are so many unknowns about it, and that became very intriguing to me. And just reading about people's experiences, they had there was a certain dramatic impulse, and a quiet dramatic impulse in it that I felt really compelled to write about. But it did take me a long time to justify it. And partly I justified it through my research. I really sat down for a few years and I actually had to learn how to research. You know, that was kind of self-taught as well. It's not like I had a degree in English, but I'm not a historian or anything. And then partly reading writers like Michael Ondaatje. You know, he wrote his first book about Billy the Kid, you know, and had never traveled to the place, you know, and he invented diaries of Billy the Kid, or reading Cullen McCann, writing about Rudolf Nureyev. You know, I kind of realized that actually, you know, you do have license to write about things that are not your own experience.
You talk about dramatic impulse, and of course, your background is primarily in the theater. What did you do up until you wrote this novel, and are you still working in the theater?
So I was a theater director. I started a small company in Dublin with a few friends of mine, and then I trained with an Irish company. I worked in Steppenwolf in Chicago. I worked at some theaters in London. But it was one of the advantages of being a theater director is film is kind of getting to that stage where you can just get a bunch of your friends and make work. And that really appealed to me. So I think it did teach me a lot about, you know, just about communicating a story. And so I'm a novelist. You know, I think part of the discovery of this book was to really own that and kind of define that. But, you know, I'm not averse to going back to theater. It is a love of mine as well.
So tell us the story of All That Is Solid Melts Into Air.
It's a group of characters who are living around that time. Some of them are in Moscow, some are in Belarus. The novel really came together for me when I read a Russian physicist quoting H.G. Wells, and he compares the events at an atomic level in a nuclear reaction to the breakdown of tradition in society. And so reading about, you know, reading about the history of the time, Chernobyl really did accelerate. It really was the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, and it kind of accelerated that end. So the book is primarily about the Chernobyl disaster, but it's actually about the entire political system falling around. So it's about a group of characters whose lives are coming apart as their whole political system is coming apart, as their environment is coming apart. And we kind of just trace their journey and see how they interlink with each other.
We'll talk about the title in a second, because that's one of the epigraphs. But the other epigraph is, I'm assuming, from some of that H.G. Wells reading that you did, which I'll read out loud. "To my mind, radioactivity is a real disease of matter. Moreover, it is a contagious disease. It spreads. You bring those debased and crumbling atoms near others, and those who presently catch the trick of swinging themselves out of coherent existence. It is in matter exactly what the decay of our old culture is in society. A loss of traditions and distinctions and assured reactions." How does that play out in the novel?
I mean, that's a theme right there. You know, the breakdown of tradition, the breakdown of assured reactions. So one of the advantages of being an Irish writer is that I was writing in the middle of the Irish Celtic Tiger. And, you know, we were going through that process of great traditional change. You know, we were casting aside a lot of our old traditions. So it is something that I could relate to.
You start off the novel with a young boy, Yevgeny. It's quite a distressing scene. Talk about what happens in that scene and why you opened it that way.
Yeah, I start with Yevgeny, who's a musical prodigy. He's 9 years old, and he gets his fingers broken by a couple of boys in his class. And I think I wanted to write, so much of the reading that I was reading about Russia was about the idea of strength. And I think we can't really relate to how important that is in Russian culture. You know, we look at photographs of Putin on horseback with his shirt off and we laugh at them. But actually, that is such an integral part of Russian culture. It is so important to embody that strength. I read a quote by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who, you know, essentially documented the whole Gulag experience. And he actually said, I think when Putin came to power, he said, finally, we will be strong again as a nation, which was an extraordinary thing for him to say. So I think we don't really understand that. And that was very fascinating to me. So I wanted to write a character that was working in contrast to that culture, who was quite a feeble character almost. And so we have this piano prodigy who's coming to terms with himself as an artist as well.
The disaster happened in 1986, in April 1986, and you write about it. How much research did you do about the actual disaster, nuclear accident itself? And how did you decide how much of that to put in? Because I imagine there were all these, you know, incredible details that you ultimately decided to leave out.
Yeah, I mean, I spent, I suppose, when I was speaking about learning how to research, I mean, my first kind of year and a half was just trawling through these very dense technical manuals and, you know, and assiduously taking notes. And then after, you know, realizing that much of that wasn't important. And since actually writing the novel, I have come back to a lot of that initial research and have begun to understand the scientific implications and the environmental and human implications of it. But I began to realize that actually the core of the story needs to be human experience. And there is actually quite a lot of documented human experiences. A wonderful book by Svetlana Alexeyevich, who's a journalist. She's a Ukrainian journalist, and she went around and took testimony from people. And it's a really shocking, very raw book. And so, you know, that was kind of my guidepost. And then also, actually, in terms of choosing the material, Chernobyl in very strange ways was far easier to research, actually, about Chernobyl in the mid-80s than it was about Moscow, simply because the culture of secrecy and the culture of kind of the repression of expression had embedded itself so much that people really weren't writing that much in the mid-80s. I found a Russian photographer, and he said he was a street photographer, and he said that one of the reasons that there was very little street photography was that people immediately suspected he was a spy. And so there wasn't really that much material. There was a lot of official material or news kind of broadcasts, but not in terms of a social level. So actually, interestingly, that became more difficult to research.
As you mentioned, there's a sort of whole cast of characters, but talk about the two main characters, Grigory and Maria.
Grigory is a surgeon based in Moscow. We look back on Chernobyl with a certain amount of experience, but actually when it happened at the time, it is an accident that is unprecedented throughout human history, and medically unprecedented as well. So a lot of medical experts or even just day-to-day doctors arrived at the site having to kind of begin again and really, start the process of healing people with great radioactivity, or at least treating people with acute radioactivity. And it's not something that we've ever had to do before as a species. So these people were placed in these extraordinary positions. A lot of the kind of scientists and top medical people also, they had achieved their status by towing the line in the Soviet system. So suddenly they were forced to look at their own culpability in the affairs. And so Grigory kind of embodies that struggle. He's a moral figure, but he's a moral figure who has risen through the ranks of a very corrupt system. And there's a, for me, that kind of was the draw of him.
And Maria, by contrast, the system conquers her.
Yeah, I mean, she was a dissident journalist who had been silenced, essentially. And so I suppose she probably represents the other side of it, which is the idea of identity and individuality and the responsibility of the individual to speak up in times of great oppression.
There's a lot of detail that you include in the book, very specific to the time and place, the amount of iodine that they had on hand in Chernobyl to treat people with, things like the level of inflation of certain products in the year after in Moscow. How true to life are those details? And did you feel sort of obligated to have that sort of all factually backed up, or did you take liberties?
For me, the thing about research was that research can kill you, like artistically. It can really stultify your book. However, anything that was about Chernobyl, I did feel a responsibility, because nobody has really written a novel about it before, to really be true to that. So pretty much the Chernobyl sections, they're as was. Some of them are slight fictionalizations, but it's very grounded in actual reality. The Moscow sections, I felt, I had a little bit more space to paint a city in my own imagination.
And you didn't go to Russia for 9 of the years that you were working on this, right?
Yeah.
But when did you go, and what was that like, and did that change what you had been working on?
Yeah, that was quite bizarre. I mean, part of the reason I didn't, there was very practical reasons. I actually couldn't afford it. I didn't come from an MFA. I'm not, I wasn't writing within the kind of confines of a program. So, I'm a guy sitting in a room writing a novel about Chernobyl who's from Ireland. So that just sounded like such an outlandish thing to do that I took a long time before I admitted that to myself, and a very long time before I admitted that to other people. But actually, there was an advantage in that I really had to work my imaginative muscle to recreate that world. And actually, I do think it became a much richer experience because of that. Getting to Moscow was a very bizarre experience. There are sections in the book that I had described very in great detail about specific areas in Moscow. And one of the ways that I did that, I think probably Google Maps now will give you the whole 360 view of Moscow. But at the time, you get on Google Maps and then there's panoramic photos. So you kind of know what's in the area. And so I kind of put it together in my imagination and then arrived there. And my sense of scale was totally blown out of proportion, which was interesting. So, it was almost like seeing a familiar painting in a gallery, but just been completely shocked about the scale of it.
Did you go back and rewrite?
What I ended up doing was refining. So I specifically walked and searched around for my characters' homes, actually. And so I found Grigory's apartment. I found Maria's apartment. So I walked a lot in the suburbs of Moscow and through those kind of ubiquitous tower blocks and spent a lot of time with a hoodie sweatshirt and keeping my hood up and keeping my head down, but really trying to find specifically where they lived. And that kind of helped just ground it a little bit more.
Before you published the book, did you have anyone from Chernobyl read it?
I did, actually. So after I'd signed my publishing deal, I sent it to the lady in the charity. Her name is Eddie Roach. And so she read it, and then she sent it out to some people from the area. I also had a couple of Russian people read it as well. And, I was very aware of not taking liberties and trying to get that as right as I could. But I wanted to go as far on my own as I could before I aligned myself to anybody else.
What kind of feedback did they give you?
They were pretty shocked at accuracy, actually. Accuracy is the kind of is the question that I keep getting asked all the time. And Chernobyl, I mean, it's such a surreal event, but because I based it, you know, so definitely on witness testimony and survivor testimony, even though it feels like a slightly surreal novel, it is so grounded in reality. And I think people who had experienced that and went through that and recognized that were, you know, there was a sense of gratitude that someone was telling their story.
Let's talk finally about the title.
That's a quote from the Communist Manifesto from Karl Marx. And it really fit. You know, it sat into that niche where H.G. Wells is talking about the breakdown of society. And Marx actually, you know, Marx does, he writes very complicatedly, but some of his sentences are very beautiful. And I think if you think about the nature of a nuclear reactor and actually the physical reality of that, it you know, it really sets in mind the picture of that power plant breaking down and radiation flooding through an entire continent. I mean, 110 million people lived on land that was contaminated by Chernobyl. So there's something, I think Marx encapsulated that kind of expanse.
All right, Dar, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
The novel, again, is All That Is Solid Melts Into Air by Dara McKeown, reviewed this week in the Book Review by Anthony Mara. Carl Sagal and Greg Coles join me now to talk about what's going on in the publishing world. Very specifically to talk about our cover review this week, Patty Smith on Haruki Murakami. Patty is in Europe on tour right now and unable to join us, but we will talk amongst ourselves. Hi, Greg. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Pamela.
So, Greg, you've read the novel. Tell us a little bit.
Sure. So the title is Colorless Tsukuru Tazaki and His Years of Pilgrimage. It is a little bit of a mysterious title, as you often get with Murakami, but it breaks down very plainly once you read the book. Colorless because the main character, Tsukuru Tazaki, was one of five friends, and each of the four other friends has a last name that connotes a color in Japanese. One of them means something like black rock, and one means green field. You know, various names that have that, and they shorten them so that all four of them are just the colors now. It's Miss White, Miss Black.
Every time I read about this, I think of Reservoir Dogs.
Well, I think of Clue.
Why Mr. Pink? But I do go on.
And Tsukuru Tazaki alone among them does not have a name that connotes a color. His last name, Tazaki, means to build or to make. And in fact, he grows up to become a builder. He's a civic engineer. He designs and redesigns train stations. He's had this lifelong love of train stations. And so he's a little bit on the outs. And during college, during his sophomore year of college, he is suddenly and inexplicably evicted from the group of friends. One of them tells him, look, we don't want you talking to us anymore. We don't want you calling us. And he adheres to that, and he doesn't understand what's going on. But
what he's
he
done.
Exactly. Yeah. He just knows that they don't want him around anymore. And so he's kind of banished. And so his years of pilgrimage are, you know, quite literally years like in the wilderness. It says lost years. It's also a reference to the years of pilgrimage, the Liszt composition that he listens to and that draws him eventually back to figure out what happened with that group of friends.
Music often plays a part in Murakami's work, particularly classical and jazz.
Yeah, he's a big jazz fan and often seems to write according to an improvisational jazz aesthetic where he just kind of follows where the story takes him and seems to be making it up as he goes along in a way that's very organic, you know, really kind of oddly compelling. He tells these great stories, but you're not quite sure how he's doing it. And it is often like following a jazz solo. In this case, it's structured more as a classical work. It's organized around this, especially one movement of the Years of Pilgrimage called Le Mal du Pays.
But the structure is interesting. And he does write to sort of figure out what happens. And he sort of describes his experience of writing like a video game where he's both designing it and playing it and sort of...
What a great metaphor.
Right? Isn't that? Yeah. But I mean, if you read his books, you like that sort of unresolved quality, right? That feels very much like Kafka, but he just can set these things up and then sort of like has this immense power and authority to let it sort of
He also gets away with it. You know, there's often a surreal element or the stories are very dreamlike, again, like Kafka. Yeah. And so anything that kind of isn't making sense, it just feels like it's part of this great unspoken dreamscape.
But also this logic, right? And he's a writer of like these like very few but intense obsessions. A few years ago, Grant Snyder did a great Murakami bingo for us that said things that keep popping up. Empty wells, railroads.
Spaghetti.
Oh, my God, the spaghetti constantly. There's constantly spaghetti bubbling somewhere. Cats, missing cats. Objects that disappear slowly. So yeah, like you do feel anchored as you're in this like fuzzy dream world that there are these totems and they do make some sort of dreamlike sense.
Murakami himself is a runner, but swimming often turns
up in a nonfiction book about running.
Yeah.
And a nonfiction book about the sarin attacks
on the subway. Yes, exactly. So yeah. Trains again.
Trains are huge with him. And he actually says that he thinks a lot about his reader. So he tries to write books that the salarymen and salarywomen, who generally in Tokyo especially have a two-hour commute, can enjoy. And that's why his bigger books he publishes in two volumes. And he tries, and again, who knows how serious he's being. He might be impish, but he wants to include a laugh every 10 pages.
So, he's a huge figure internationally, but especially in Japan. I think this book sold 1 million copies in its first week.
Yeah. It did, yeah. It was almost like a Harry Potter phenomenon. It went on sale at midnight in bookstores, and people lined up to buy it. And yeah, you're exactly right.
That happens all the time here. Let's talk a little bit about our review this week, which was written by Patti Smith. To some people, might seem like an oddball match, but Patti Smith, of course, the musician and author of the memoir Just Kids, is a huge Murakami fan. And Greg, you ended up working with her on this
review. I did. I did not make the assignment. Pamela, you did that. And it was a tremendous assignment. She was great on this book.
And she's currently on tour, as I mentioned earlier. So you were editing this with her as she went on and off stage.
It is the first review I've ever edited. Hopefully it will not be the last, where I called a reviewer to go over some edits. And she said, look, I need to call you back. I'm due on stage in 15 minutes. I was talking to her backstage and she was, you know, getting ready, doing her vocal exercises. And she was going to go on stage in 15 minutes. So I talked to her a little bit later and she said the concert went great. They love her in Estonia.
All right. We're going to have to line up our favorite rock musician reviewers so that we can give you another opportunity.
But she was very smart about this book. She has read all of Murakami, including books that I had not even heard of that she brings into this review. She's a real completist. A collector of rare books, it turns out. She paid $200, I think, for a first edition of his early novel, Pinball, 1973.
That's a great title.
It is. And she identifies these two strains of Murakami's writing. He does these minimalist, kind of very grounded and realistic works on the one hand, and on the other hand, these works that tap into the subconscious and kind of other dimensions. This she calls it an interdimensionality. Mm-hmm. She expresses a clear preference for that second kind of book, the surreal.
Which is what Murakami himself, he says that he writes a lot of these realist books to sort of hook readers into what he's doing, into his project, which is this great surreal picture of explicitly Japan, Japanese life.
He also, I mean, he's very grounded in American literature and minimalism. He was an early translator into Japanese of Raymond Carver's short stories.
Raymond Chandler.
Basically anybody named Ray.
Isn't that another Grant Snyder cartoon that he did for us, The Three Rays?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It all comes together in a Murakami kind of way. All right, Greg, Carl, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pamela.
Christopher Beha joins me now to talk about his new novel, Arts and Entertainment. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So tell us about this novel and how you came up with the idea.
The novel is about a failed actor named Eddie Hartley,
who is given the opportunity to sell a tape he has of himself and his ex-girlfriend, whose name is Martha Martin, who is now a famous actress. And it is a sex tape. And he sells this sex tape because he needs money for IVF. He and his wife are attempting to have a child. And he thinks he can do it in a way that will get the tape out into the world but keep him out of it, and he can just walk away with the money, and that will be that.
And
will
what
be
year
it.
Does this naivete exist?
This is circa 2006.
Okay. Where does it fall in the timeline of sex tapes?
The world of the sex tape already exists. This is sort of post-Kim Kardashian. Someone approaches him and asks if he has this material. So it's something that is considered an option, this leaking of a sex tape.
Right.
And of course, he winds up in various complications and eventually winds up on a reality television show.
Okay. And there's a bad guy here, a devil.
Yeah. So there's kind of a couple of devils, but the prime one is a reality television producer named Moody, who is sort of present in the background from the beginning of the book. He has he's the producer of various reality shows.
You have to tell us about a couple of these because so the ideas are fun.
There's one called Huffing and Cuffing, which is about police officers who are addicted to paint thinner.
Did you have like a list of 20 possibilities before you settled on these?
I had a number, and some got discarded. There's one called Puppy Mill Tycoon, which actually came from a friend of mine. Some of them I discarded as being too outrageous. But if anything,
and the others you've taken to Hollywood directly.
Yeah. I think that people are finding that that the ones that I included seem, if anything, too plausible. Which is one of the things about trying to satirize this kind of culture that is so ridiculous.
What made you think, okay, I want to write a novel about reality TV?
So it came from a perhaps odd place, which was an Edith Wharton story.
Isn't that where everyone
gets? Yes, everyone gets the reality television satires from Edith Wharton. She wrote a story called That Good May Come, which was an early story about a failed writer who is trying to sell his poems to newspapers, and no editors want to buy them, but one editor does want to buy essentially a blind item, a gossip item. He's told a story about a woman they both know, a sort of scandalous story, and the editor says, I'll buy this off of you if you want to write up this sketch. And so then in a fairly melodramatic fashion, Wharton plays out the kind of moral choice of this artist who is very impoverished. And I read the story, and I thought it would be very interesting to update because it seemed to have in it a lot of very contemporary feeling themes.
So did you follow the full arc of that story of someone where you go
didn't.
And read that and then?
I didn't. I did. I sort of thought I would. I also thought the thing I was writing was itself going to be a short story, and it would be about the choice of whether or not to sell this tape. But what became obvious to me very quickly is that the interesting stuff is what happens after you sell.
Yes.
So there's none of that in the Wharton story, or very little of that. It's really about this sort of moral choice. And the first draft I wrote of this book was not especially comic. It was meant to be about a moral choice. And then I realized that the story was ending just when things were getting good.
Right. It is in the end both, right? It is a
yes.
comedy and about a moral choice.
Yeah. And my models as comic writers are people, particularly Evelyn Waugh, but are comic writers who are satirists who are writing comedy with a moral edge to it, whose comedy is driven at least in part by sort of a sense of outrage.
I think a lot of people are outraged by reality TV in many ways, but what to you is the outrage here?
One thing about reality television, it seems to me, is that it is deeply inimical to the inner life. And that to me is the thing that novels are best at exploring is, you know, the what goes on inside of each of us as we are interacting out in the world. And what I don't hesitate to call the soul, which is sort of an unfashionable way to put it these days. I think that reality television is bad for our souls. I think that, you know, good novels ought to be trying to restore that sense of the importance of the inner life and the importance of those elements of existence that are not easily documented by social media or
I was about
television.
To say, does social media kind of make reality stars of us all in a way?
I think there's something to that. And I'm on Twitter quite a bit. I am not interested in implicating others in something I'm not also implicating myself in. This is not about standing outside of it and pointing fingers. But I think that there is a real danger to being able to publicize every thought as it arises. I think that there's less contemplation. There's less sort of revision of thought, for lack of a better term. Very often, I think the most interesting ideas are the ones that get stuck in you and you trouble over for a while and work on until you get it right and then make some kind of careful expression of it. And what happens often with social media is, you know, first thought, best thought.
And you mentioned the soul. There is definitely a religious element to the story. How does that enter into the novel?
I do think to some extent there are certain religious ideas, particularly ideas about the dignity of each individual person, can be a counterweight to some of these trends in our culture that are exemplified by reality television. On some level, I suppose it's just part of how I see the world. My previous novel, What Happened to Sophie Wilder, was explicitly a religious novel. I did not set out in this book to really be writing about religion at all, but I found myself, when thinking through the issues that the book raises, religion was constantly coming up, and so it seemed inevitable that it was going to work its way into the novel.
What are those issues?
The first issue, I think, is that what religion opposes in contemporary life, it seems to me, is a particular kind of materialism that is very grounded in empirical fact, and that says that things that can't be observed by a third-person observer and quantified are not real in the same way that physical data are real. And I think that, you know, this tendency towards social media publication of every thought, the tendency towards documentation that reality television participates in, all of that is, to my mind, in part, a response to this kind of prevailing idea of materialism that I think religion opposes.
Just the phrase reality TV, with the reality in there and the unrealness of it, is so ripe for satire. Was it hard to satirize something that's sort of, you know, almost satirical in its very essence?
I have some friends who are reality television producers, and
it's like your card or something.
Yeah.
some of your best friends are reality.
Yeah, some of my best friends are reality television producers. These are very smart people, as most people who are involved in making sort of mass culture are very smart, talented people, and they know what they're doing, and it's not naive. So one of the things I discovered that wound up being very important to me in writing the novel, when I talked with my friends who work for reality television, is that they have a kind of set of conventions for representing reality, which is something that the novelist has as well. When people talk about realist fiction, often what they mean is this a particular set of conventions that the novelist puts to use to represent reality on the page. And they are similarly using a set of conventions. The one good example is in something I used in the book that came from these shows are these interviews that the participants give that are given after the events that are being shown on the show. But the interviewee speaks in the present tense so that they can then be run as sort of voiceover, and they become kind of internal monologue mm-hmm. of a person narrating their experience as it happens to them, when in fact it's that person sitting in a room after the fact speaking in the present tense.
It says a lot about how we create stories, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, even when they're in the actual moment, they're not just living that moment, but they're sort of creating a scene of that moment
right.
while it's happening, and then creating the narrative.
Yes, absolutely. And it's one of the ways that reality gets distorted, because people start to think, and you know, there's the equivalent of people who feel like they're living in a novel as they walk through their lives, and they're doing the voiceover in the same way. This idea that you should be both living your life and standing outside of it, commenting on it or observing it, or that exists.
And existed before there was reality TV.
Right,
and some
right.
of us just did that out of bad habit.
Right, absolutely. Or did it because of literature. There's a long tradition in the novel that certainly goes back to Don Quixote. Everyone knows that Don Quixote was under the misapprehension that he was a knight errant. But not everyone knows that he got that idea from reading bad books. And, you know, both Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina read essentially bad romance novels, and this is the thing that leads them to become fallen women. And so that tradition that bad representations of reality can be pernicious in this way is built into the history of the novel in very interesting ways. So this is not something that's specific to television or to reality television at all.
It went from being bad books to being reality TV
right.
and Twitter.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's just go back to the story for a moment without giving too much away, and talk a little bit about what happens when this sex tape gets out.
So, as I mentioned, he sells the tape in order to pay for IVF for his wife. And his wife does indeed get pregnant with triplets. And as people who watch reality television know, multiples are one of the great fascinations.
I thought you had to have like at least 17.
I think three is not quite enough. But given the addition of the triplets to the sex tape narrative, people become very interested not in Eddie himself, but in his wife. And so the same things that played out with his ex-girlfriend becoming famous sort of play out all over again. His wife, who didn't want any part in this, becomes a figure of celebrity fascination. And then he sort of winds up trying to get himself into the narrative. And he does so by making various efforts to actually portray himself as kind of a slime ball. He gets an underage girl to pretend to be his girlfriend, and these, because he realizes that the most important thing if you want people's attention is just to be interesting.
When did you realize it's going to be the wife who becomes famous and he who becomes the...
You know, it all happened pretty quickly and pretty instinctively. It seemed too easy to have Eddie just finally get the fame that he all along wanted from selling this tape. There had to be a little bit of an ironic twist to it. So it seemed interesting to make the person who wasn't interested in fame, his wife Susan, who has no particular desire to be a celebrity and was never an actor, to have her get the fame and then see how she responds to it and how it changes her.
All right. And in a meta twist, all this will, of course, become itself a reality TV show.
That would be great.
Chris Beja, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The novel, again, is Arts and Entertainments by Christopher Beja, reviewed this week by Michael Ian Black. Greg Coles is back now with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
There are four new titles on the hardcover fiction list. Amy Bloom's new novel, Lucky Us, hits the list at number 16. That Amy Bloom novel is reviewed in this week's issue. Then at number 13, the seventh book in a series by Alona Andrews called Magic Breaks. That's new at number 13. It's part of her Kate Daniels series. Then at number six, the romance writer Julie Garwood has a book called Fast Track. That's sort of loosely part of a series. It continues the story of three friends that she's been telling over the last decade or so. This one focuses on the friend Cordelia of the three friends she's been talking about. It's one of her contemporary novels. Garwood first rose to fame as a historical romance writer, but she's mostly turned away from that in her more recent books. Then finally, new at number one this week, there is a new book by Leanne Moriarty, who hit it huge last year with her novel The Husband's Secret. That novel is still doing very well. It's at number 17 on the extended list, so selling just below Amy Bloom. The new one, Big Little Lies, makes a big splash this week right at number one.
And nonfiction, not much going on.
No, there's only one new title on the nonfiction list this week. It's a good one. It's Ben McIntyre's new book, A Spy Among Friends. That is his book about the Kim Philby spy case in the Cold War. Kim Philby, of course, the famous British double agent. That book's been getting just great reviews, and it's reflected in its sales this week. It comes in all the way at number two. Of course, Walter Isaacson reviewed it for us on our cover a couple of weeks ago.
And of course, Ben was a guest on the podcast as well. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.